everyone, welcome back to the Towards Data Science podcast. Now, today's episode is somewhat special because we're going to be talking about what might be the first solid quantitative study of the power-seeking tendencies that we can expect advanced AI systems to have in the future. Now, for a long time, there's kind of been this debate in the AI safety community between people who worry that powerful AIs could eventually displace or even eliminate humanity altogether as they find more clever, creative, and dangerous ways to optimize their reward metrics, and people who say that's Terminator baiting Hollywood nonsense that anthropomorphizes machines in a way that's deeply unhelpful and misleading. Now, unfortunately, recent work in AI alignment, and in particular here, a spotlighted 2021 NeurIPS paper, suggests that the AI takeover argument might be stronger than many had realized. In fact, it's starting to look like we ought to expect to see power-seeking behaviors from highly capable AI systems by default. Now, these behaviors include things like AI systems preventing us from shutting them down, or repurposing resources in ways that are pathological and serve their objectives, and even in the limit, generating catastrophes that would put humanity at risk. And as concerning as these possibilities might be, it's exciting nonetheless that we're starting to develop a robust and quantitative language to describe AI failures and power seeking, which is exactly why I'm so excited to talk to AI researcher Alex Turner, the author of the spotlighted NeurIPS paper on power seeking, about his path into AI safety, his research agenda, and the future of AI on this episode of the Towards Data Science podcast. I'm really excited to have this conversation, actually. You know, it's not every day you get to talk to the author of a NeurIPS highlighted paper. Let alone one on alignment too, which I think is, this kind of feels like a first and a big moment for alignment, not to butter you up too much here, but anyway, it's kind of exciting and I'm sure we'll get into it. I'd love to talk to you, though, first about your interest in alignment research, because I think every alignment researcher has a pretty interesting story that kind of leads them to where they are. What's yours? Like, how did you get to this space?
So it all started in 2014, or I suppose it didn't start in 2014. I was scrolling through my Facebook feed and I saw some hyperbolic news article about how scared Elon Musk was of AI. And I rolled my eyes and I was like, Elon, you don't know what you're talking about. AI is so great. And I just kept scrolling through the feed. And so I thereby lost, I think, about 4 years of work I could have done on alignment, just scrolling past that. And I didn't really seriously think about the issue till late 2017, when I read Nick Bostrom's Superintelligence. His book, Superintelligence. I just sat down with it for a week and I thought about it seriously. And I realized that the arguments made a lot of sense. And I looked around online for the best counter arguments, and there didn't really seem to be very many good ones that had, you know, actually read the work. Seemed like there's mostly just kind of bouncing off the way I had, you know, just looking at the idea, and it seems a little kind of out there or sci-fi and not really engaging with it anymore. And so I became pretty convinced that this was, you know, worth working on, that it was worth developing more and figuring out. And I wasn't working on alignment at the time. I was in the second year of my PhD program. I'm now in my final year. My original advisor wasn't really that enthusiastic about alignment work. So I changed up my graduate committee to have a better fit. I changed advisors. I got some independent funding from the Long-Term Future Fund to buy out my teaching so that I could work on alignment for my PhD. So ever since then, that's about 3 years ago, I've been working with the Center for Human Compatible AI at UC Berkeley, where I actually will be going as a postdoc or research fellow when I graduate this year. And I've also worked with the Future of Humanity Institute just this last summer.
And actually, to your point about, you know, you've lost 4 productive years of research time since you first kind of bounced off the topic, it does make me wonder a little bit. I mean, alignment research seems to have evolved quite a bit in terms of its focus. There seems now, for example, to be a lot more emphasis on prosaic AI, like AI as it appears today, deep learning, reinforcement learning as a potential vector for AGI development. Whereas it seemed like maybe circa 2014, there might have been a little bit more uncertainty. I wonder, I mean, do you think that the fact that you pivoted into alignment research when you did meant that you ended up focusing on something very different rather than maybe getting pigeonholed in a less sort of prosaic AI oriented direction?
Maybe. I don't think it really affected my research direction a whole lot. I've worked more on theory. I've worked on understanding like the general case of across a range of different procedures by which we might get to AI or AGI. What's that going to look like? What properties will it have? Will it tend to be aligned? Will it tend to be power seeking? How will it tend to affect us? And this research, I think, is somewhat independent of the recent success we've had since 2014 in deep learning. But for many other people, I think this could be true. Although, you know, you might hope that you'd be flexible enough to notice a new trend and focus more of your research attention on it.
And just before we get into the nuts and bolts of the power seeking argument and research that you've been doing, I am curious about that Nick Bostrom piece. So do you remember a particular argument that changed your view from like, oh, this is an Elon Musk thing, yeah, pay no attention, to, hey, this is something I should really be focusing on? Like, was there something like that? Or was it more an overarching kind of distilled sense of what the book was saying?
Rather than it being one particular argument, I think I had assumed that since it wasn't already consensus, it was a big deal worth worrying about, there had to be something wrong with the argument. But when I went through the argument, and especially when I went through the lack of careful engagement with Bostrom's arguments, I realized that this wasn't the case, that there wasn't some detailed, you know, rebuttal or reason to not worry about it, but rather it was a pretty good argument. And people weren't that worried about it on average. And so this really made me kind of detach from that prior expectation I had that, well, if, you know, if it were such a big deal, why wouldn't I hear about it? And now I don't expect that to be true. I don't expect that to be true in a lot of realms, including this one.
Yeah.
I think there's like not a whole lot of, and I think the incentives aren't there for that right now. The incentives aren't there for people to be able to go into alignment research if it were really that important, and then kind of profit off of it personally, career-wise, be recognized as doing good research if they fill an important gap in the alignment literature, in part because alignment isn't about the things that we're building today, somewhat. It's mostly, I think, most of its importance is tied to things that we haven't built yet, which means it's hard for people to like do something, and then everyone recognizes, hey, this made a big practical impact, because that practical impact is an expectation in the future. So I think there's a lot of reasons that this problem is kind of is under focused right now. That may be one of the important reasons why.
Is it also like the subcategory of sort of so-called alignment research? Because it seems to me that there are sort of two camps. Like one camp is more engineering focused. Like we'll build a GPT-3, it'll have behavior that we don't like, and then we'll tweak the model and we'll call that alignment research. Whereas the other camp seems more focused on the maybe more theoretical kind of existential risk, the idea of this one shot that we have at aligning a superhuman AGI, that sort of thing. Like, do you see that clean separation, or do you think that actually that in the limit there's sort of a continuum between the two, and it's not obvious how to separate them?
So are you asking whether I differentiate these two kinds of research, this modern empirical research on like large models like GPT-3? Do I differentiate its alignment legitimacy from more theoretical work?
So I'm going back to your point about essentially the economics of alignment research. So if it's the case that I can do research, alignment research on current systems like GPT-3 and make money off that, like I am sort of adding value because we can squeeze more value out of a system that is aligned in that engineering kind of sense, that creates an economic gradient towards alignment research. And if that kind of alignment research pushed to the limit leads to existential risk mitigation, then that seems like a good thing. But if existential risk mitigation is just a completely separate theoretical domain, if the people who work on it are just different people from the people who work on sort of the engineering side, then that's much more concerning from an economic standpoint, if that makes sense.
Right. So I think there's very useful empirical work we can be doing today. I think it's hard to figure out what exactly that is. If you look at Redwood Research, a new alignment lab that is working on fine-tuning GPT-3, I believe, so that it doesn't ever describe situations where there's violence Like, can you make this robustly be true that it just won't talk about violent things? That's my recollection, at least, of their research. And whether you can do this or not, with systems or with models about as intelligent as GPT-3, tells us important things about the parameters of the alignment problem. So we could live in different worlds with respect to robustness, with respect to how generalization works across human-like concepts. Like, can the system just totally grok the concept? Can that be natural for it? And can we figure out if that's the case today? And I think we can to some extent. So there's thoughtful empirical work that I think is very useful for ActRisk. But I think by default, that's not the kind of work that's incentivized. The kind of work that's incentivized is going to be very legible, very clear to modern researchers that, hey, here's something that's happening right now. Here's what we did about it. I don't usually expect that to line up with the longer term, or the future, at least, important alignment empirical work. Like, I think that the main factor governing the usefulness of Redwood's work isn't the direct ask of the AI system, the ask of don't talk about violence. It's what it tells us about how robustly it can learn these concepts, and not necessarily with the intention of just getting it to straightforwardly, we've got GPT-N, or we've got some model-based superhuman RL system in the future. Not necessarily using that to directly just make it grok human values, but rather just informing our theory of how alignment works and using that to build better approaches. You could try just getting it to grok it in the future in like a very optimistic world. I mean, I guess that's a thing you could try, and maybe it's a way by which alignment turns out to be pretty easy for very intelligent agents. But I'd be surprised if that were true.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking of it in terms of, like, you know, if you wanted 100% certainty that GPT-3 was not going to put out some, you know, violent passage, that would imply that the objects that GPT-3 thinks of, the abstractions it uses, the ideas that it holds in its head, so to speak, are that we can put a clean box around those and say, hey, like, you have this idea of violence, and that idea is roughly correct or roughly maps onto what humans think of as violence. Like, don't do that thing. And that would seem to be much more X-Risk flavored. That, anyway, I guess I'm curious about this because I think it informs how people think about what domain to enter, because, like, there are a lot of boxes that have the word alignment on them, but many of them seem not to contain the kind of work that leads to existential risk mitigation. Yeah, and I find that to be, anyway, an interesting paradigm. On to more X-Risk flavored stuff, maybe, or your own work, which I think is really, really fascinating. So can you, this might be too much to ask, but can you just kind of lay out the case that you make in the Optimal Policies Tend to Seek Power paper?
In this paper, we look at something called instrumental convergence, or simply the tendency of a range of smart agents to take similar actions. So if you want to go buy something, no matter what in particular you want to buy, you'll probably get in your car to do that. And so it's this preliminary action that's helpful for a range of things you want to do. So some, like, alignment researchers like Bostrom and Stuart Russell worry that disempowering humanity by seeking power, you know, staying alive, that these are convergently instrumental actions for an AI, that they're a good idea for a wide range of different goals. And previously, this has been a little bit controversial. You'll see some other researchers that are saying, well, maybe it's just anthropomorphizing to imagine an AI seeking power. So the main contribution of this paper is grounding out this question in a formal setting, in the setting of Markov decision processes, which basically just means a setting where the AI can see everything that's happening, the AI takes actions, the world evolves, and the AI has an objective that takes in the world's state or how things are set up right now and gives back a number. So the AI is basically trying to run up its score with respect to its objective. You know, in a Pac-Man game, the reward function would be something like the score, the points gained by an action at a state. So you eat a pellet, you gain some points, that's some reward. And so what we show is that depending on the structure of the agent's environment or the world around it, the structure of the game it's playing in some settings, agents will have different statistical tendencies across their goals. So previously there'd been this informal question of when will smart AIs tend to take over the world? And this is pretty vague. It makes it feel like there's kind of two, that you could go either way. You could say, well, that doesn't sound plausible, or you could say it sounds plausible, depending on your taste and your beliefs about how we'll build AI. But this paper points out, you ground out the problem, and since it's formal, now there's one answer in the settings that we look at. And in particular, when the agent has, when the world is structured so that the agent has more options by taking action A over action B, if staying alive, for example, lets the agent do more things and reach more like future possibilities, then also most goals will make the agent, will make it optimal for the agent to stay alive. It'll make it a good idea for the agent to stay alive. And so we take this informal debate and we ground it out in terms of pretty reasonable math. And then we can imagine what happens when we relax some of the assumptions, which I do in future work. The main upshot is this is something we can talk about formally. And the formal answer in the settings we look at is that optimal policies will tend to seek power in a pretty reasonable, intuitive sense. And so I think this should, if previously you know, you looked at this and you thought, well, you know, this doesn't seem like this should really be a concern, I think this is just, this should be a pretty surprising observation. And there's several hedges I can get into and several details that we'll need to look at. This definitely doesn't prove that superintelligent AI, if we build it, that it'll seek power over us. But I think it's pretty suggestive evidence that by default, in the average case, we're looking at the AI is incentivized to seek power just for most goals. You can give it as a statistical fact.
I think there is a lot to unpack here, including the reaction to it, sort of both positive and sort of counter. And I think there's an interesting discussion to be had on that front. But I want to zero in on optimal policies and get a better sense for what optimal policies are in the context of this experiment. Could you kind of elaborate on that?
An optimal policy is one which maximizes the agent's reward over time. So it's one that maximizes how many points the agent is scoring over the course of its interaction with the world. And so in Pac-Man, an optimal policy for the classic Pac-Man reward function would just be one that runs up the score as high as possible.
Do you theoretically like demonstrate like, okay, this policy is optimal and then what can I do with that? Or
so I don't constructively take a policy and show that it's optimal. What we say is, in this kind of world where you've got more choices this way than this other way, for most objectives you give the agent, the optimal, there's going to be an optimal policy for that objective that stays alive. So we're not examining one particular setup and saying, well, this has to be optimal, and also it seeks power. We're saying generically, optimal policies for different reward functions will be seeking power.
The caveats that you might add to this. So obviously optimality of the policy for this paper, at least, is one caveat. Are there others that you want to flag, things that sort of limit the domain of applicability of the work?
So for this paper, there's some more caveats. We look at, so we assume that it's a Markov decision process, which means we're assuming that the world is fully observable and, you know, the agent can see everything that's going on all at once. And you might realize that the real world is definitely not fully observable. Many tasks we care about, especially in the embodied robotics domain, are not fully observable. The agent only has like a camera feed, for example, showing it its immediate surroundings, but not the whole world. I can talk about these caveats, what I think about how serious these caveats are.
Actually, that one I'd be curious to explore if possible, because I know that one strategy that's been looked at is intentionally blinding agents to certain parts of the world, and like in the hopes that they would not be incentivized to manipulate them. So I'm definitely curious about sort of double clicking on that and seeing what you think.
So first of all, I think that kind of strategy is pretty broken. I think if you're worried that by default the system will have bad incentives, and then there's this kind of like patch you try to slap onto it without really understanding where the bad incentives come from, and without really understanding how to motivate the agent to do the thing you actually want, You're kind of relying on the agent not being able to find a way around the patch piece, under assumption it's motivated to do so. So here, I actually already have proofs for the partially observable case, and particularly for just, you take any computable environment that the agent takes actions, it gets back some maybe incomplete observation, maybe just like a webcam frame of the world. And you can extend I extended these theorems to that case where the agent can't see everything, but still certain actions will let the agent do more things. And you'll just see this kind of enormous propensity across possible agent goals to take the power of seeking actions. So it doesn't cover all environment classes we care about. I'm looking to work with some people on extending these results to the PomDP case and not this arbitrary computable environment case, but I think there's also some interesting theorems for the partially observable Markov decision process case. But I think the moral is that this full observability is not the crux. It's not what the proofs hinge on. If you go in and look at them, it's just kind of a convenience.
Okay. And would you say those are the main caveats to put on this first piece of work then? So partial observability and then optimality of the policy, sort of those two things?
So there, I'd add a third and maybe a fourth. Third is this talks about just generically for most reward functions. So you take any reward function and most ways of modifying that reward function by swapping which states get which reward, most of its permutations will incentivize power seeking. Mm. But it might be the case that we use a featureized reward function. We have different ways of specifying reward that don't allow arbitrary reward functions. This might change the power seeking incentives. This paper just kind of zooms out and says, well, every reward function is as plausible as any other in some sense. Like, so most distributions of reward functions will, if we have some beliefs, we're like, I think that we'll probably assign a reward function like this, but maybe we'll have a different one. Well, most permutations of that distribution will also tend to incentivize power seeking. So there's a good amount of these theorems that I think are pretty strong, but they don't cover particular ways we might specify reward. So I suppose there's some loophole there.
Well, would you imagine people might counter on that and say, well, almost by definition, when we encode a reward function in an agent, that's a very informed choice. In other words, it's highly kind of, it's a sort of low, in a sense, low entropy choice, whereas you might have roughly flat prior over different reward distributions in your work. Like, what we're really interested in is a very specific set of highly tailored reward functions that humans are specifically choosing because they seem like good ideas. I don't know if you find that to be a compelling bit of pushback.
I don't really. If you look empirically, there's many cases where we think that the reward we've specified is a good idea, and it's just not. The AI, like with Coast Runners and OpenAI, they specify, they reward the agent for, you know, gaining points while completing a race, and the AI just spins in a circle because it finds a way to quickly get these respawning point power-ups. So, and this is a very simple setting. And so in more complex settings, we're just gonna have a really, really hard time. And so I don't find that argument very persuasive. You look at it empirically today, it's just not that true. It's true that if there's some information, we're not just randomly choosing a reward function, but since like, it's not clear that we actually know how to narrow it down. In particular, whenever you run at these alignment thought experiments where you formally specify an objective for an agent, and then you try to make sure that there's no plan, you try to, you know, you just imagine as best you can, this is kind of the best you can do, and say, well, are there any plans which maximize this reward? Like, what are the plans that maximize this reward? And so if you imagine rewarding an AI when its webcam shows people smiling, then there's many things it might do which are better than making people smile by the objective function. It might just like paste a photo of people smiling in front of its webcam and then make sure that no one can ever take that photo away from it, which might lead to some very bad behavior. Or it could, you know, paralyze people's facial muscles to make sure they're always smiling. Like, these objectives, which seem like good ideas, are often just not. and especially in the limit of very intelligent agents, as far as we can tell. And I think this work backs that up.
So if I can then put these two pieces together, and I'd love to know from you if you agree with this characterization, but it seems to me then that there's a two-piece argument that when you start to ask about, okay, what about this specific reward function, or what about reward functions specified by humans with the intention of being specifically good, then that kind of fails due to all the standard alignment arguments around Goodhart's law and it being impossible to specify metrics that aren't hackable, et cetera, et cetera. And then what your paper does is it takes that and says, yes, and furthermore, the one of the specific failure modes that we can anticipate leading to the disaster is related to power seeking. In other words, like the failure will in part manifest through a kind of power seeking behavior. Would that be a fair kind of way of putting those two things together?
Yeah. I think most of the really big risk comes from power seeking AI. So I think there's several things that could go wrong with AI. And so we're seeing some of them today. But I think some of the most potent risks are when we don't have as much control over the future anymore. And so you might imagine this, you don't even need a super intelligent AI to make this happen. You just need a world that's increasingly reliant on not that aligned AI systems. And so you might notice that it's harder to work and get into deep work when you've got your phone nearby, because you're just, Facebook is so well optimized to grab your attention. And so Facebook isn't a super intelligence, but it's pretty good at getting engagement. And whether or not that's done through AI today, I think it's probably going to be done through AI tomorrow. And if you imagine a world with like 1,000 different Facebook-like things in it, all competing for your resources, then this seems like a pretty bad world to live in. And so this is a way that things can go wrong without some super intelligent AI that's seeking power for itself, but instead we've got humanity becoming disempowered because of the things we're building and how they interact with us. And so this disempowerment, because most of these AIs are incentivized to seek power in our paper, you imagine, well, look at other work shows if you have an AI that's maximizing its own empowerment with a different human in the environment, then that human is like acting pretty antagonistically. It's blocking the human off, it's taking away their resources. If that happened in the real world, we would see a similar kind of disempowerment where we're just not able to steer the future how we want anymore. And that could happen kind of death by 1,000 cuts, or it could happen with a very intelligent agent or a group of intelligent agents as well. And so I think there's a range of things to worry about. I think some of them are more plausible than others, but I don't think we can dismiss any of those. I'd be really happy to see more like inquisitive exploration of what's going on with these different situations and how we might guard against them.
It does change, at least to my mind, the character of the conversation around alignment to an important degree. I mean, historically, it's been, as you said, this sort of fuzzy thing where people will say like, oh, well, like, will an AI take over the world? And this is a very abstract thing. It's easy to complain that, as you've said, that you're anthropomorphizing an AI system. Whereas grounding in math, it really seems like the one formalization of this problem shows that optimal agents do tend to exhibit this power-seeking behavior, caveats, 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 but it does feel like the onus is sort of shifting through this work, at least when it's framed in this way. I am curious then about the ultimate steel man version of this, which, you know, you're doing follow-on work where you're relaxing some of these assumptions. Could you dive into that a little bit and talk about which assumptions you're relaxing and how that's affected the conclusions?
Right. So I've already relaxed this full observability assumption. The thing I'm most excited about, though, is the optimality assumption. So I went back to the proofs, and I was looking at what properties I actually needed to make the proofs go through. And it turned out that optimality is actually pretty irrelevant. That I just needed I basically just needed the agent to make decisions in a certain kind of way that respected permutations in a certain kind of way. And I'm not going to get into the details of that, but basically there's a wide range of ways an agent could think or make choices. It's given some objective and then it makes choices based on that. Now, it might just totally randomly pick what outcome it wants to bring about. It has a uniform distribution over its available outcomes, where the outcomes could be different terminal states it ends up in, So this would be like, well, what game over state will this policy eventually lead to in the game of Pac-Man? These are the options I'm talking about, or the outcomes. And so you could have a decision-making procedure that just uniformly, randomly chooses an outcome to realize. You could have one that Boltzmann rationally chooses one, so it assigns higher probability to outcomes which score higher, but it's not perfect. It doesn't just always choose a maximizing one. You could have an agent which minimizes its utility or its reward over time. The theorem still apply. You could have an agent which randomly thinks of like five different options and then chooses the best one, and the theorem still apply. You could do even fancier things, and the theorems still apply. And so the moral was that we can extend this even to things like reinforcement learning training procedures, where you have some initial weights, you've got a policy network, you do like policy improvement on this many times as you interact with the environment. Maybe it doesn't even have some access to the transitions, but you're just doing resets and just something that looks like what we do today. You've got like PPO or something. And what this gives is a criterion that says, look, in this kind of situation where you can redirect the training process by changing the reward. So if initially you reward the agent, say, for going right, and then the training tends to produce a policy which goes to the right. Now, if you can permute this so that now you're rewarding the agent for going left, and guess what? It produces an agent which goes left. Well, under this kind of condition, the theorems will still apply, where you can redirect the agent's learned behavior by redirecting which reward goes where. Then the theorem will still apply that most reward function inputs to this procedure will, you know, maybe go left instead of right. This argument's a little bit more involved, but the upshot is there's a wide range of ways an AI could think, or we could produce an AI. Ways we eventually get a policy out of the AI. And under this wide range of procedures of randomly choosing an outcome, of minimizing expected utility, of choosing, tending to choose things that are higher scoring, but not always, that this will assign that this kind of AI will tend to seek power in the exact same sense that that happens in the optimal policies tend to seek power paper. So it's taking this constraint of optimality and zooming out and saying, well, actually, we just need this rather weak decision-making requirement and exhibiting, and then it just shows a whole bunch of decision-making procedures which satisfy it.
Interesting. And so how, I'm curious about the reception to your work. Like, have you spoken to people who've engaged with the work and have had interesting objections that have given you pause or that have changed your thinking on the conclusions of the paper? Or the work in general.
A couple, mostly within the alignment community. Mm. I think it's been an exercise in thinking carefully about applying theorems to the real world. But I think that the theorems come out unscathed to the extent that they're still suggestive and still evidence of this power seeking phenomenon. But most of the engagement so far has been through the AI alignment community.
Mm. Okay. No, that makes sense. It's sort of what I would have naively expected going in. Particularly, I mean, unfortunately, I get the sense that there are so many layers to the onion of alignment, and so many people are stuck at the outer layers but think that they're closer to the center. And I've come across this in doing this podcast itself, speaking with, sort of putting my cards on the table here. I am sort of more of an alignment hawk, but I have spoken to folks who consider themselves to be knowledgeable about this stuff, but don't know, for example, basic concepts like instrumental convergence. And some of them are very kind of sort of well-known members of the AI community more broadly, which is why it was so nice to see this highlighted at NeurIPS, sort of giving more credibility, giving more attention to this line of work. Where do you see the research program going from here? And actually, specifically, I do want to ask, do you see a path that connects what you're doing right now to actual solutions or kind of ways to mitigate alignment risk in the future?
So first of all, I want to comment on what you said about this kind of this iceberg meme of alignment, which I think is pretty true. And I think alignment at first, it feels maybe deceptively straightforward. We'll figure out how to build smart AI. And if we come to that, then we'll figure out how to make it do what we want more. And then we just improve it until it's doing what we want. And if, like, on a first pass, it feels like, well, okay, this is usually how we do things. You know, we usually make an invention, then we improve it. So why wouldn't that work? And I think that's a good question. But there's a lot of layers to this. And I think when all said and done and like the cognitive dust settles, at least pretty clear, at least to me, that's just like not going to work. And so the problem is it's not clear. There's arguments you can make, which I think are very compelling, but they take some time and engagement. And so I'd be very excited to talk with people, whether they agree with the conclusions of this paper or they think it's, you know, misguided. I'd be very excited to talk with them more about this, because I think it can be pretty non-obvious. At least for me, it was definitely something I bounced off of at first and didn't find very compelling. So if anyone's listening and would be interested in talking more, then you can feel free to send me an email. With respect to your questions about the future of this agenda and how it might help maybe constructively with a solution, I currently don't see a way for this to help constructively with the solution. And one of the reasons is it's talking about reward functions. It's talking about utility functions. And I think that reward functions are a pretty broken way of getting good behavior out of a very intelligent system operating in the real world. Now, for narrow tasks, I think they can be pretty appropriate, especially when you want the system to operate in a narrow domain. It's only like cleaning dishes or something. It's not like optimizing the whole world to contain like as many clean dishes as possible, but it's only cleaning dishes. And because our current AI like training algorithms are not that good, we're just simply not going to run into the second kind of AI. And I think reward's pretty appropriate. It's pretty fruitful. It's economically valuable. It's fine. But I think in the long run, it's just not a good language for specifying what kind of behavior we want from an AI. In particular, it doesn't let us correct an AI. So if we give it a reward function and let's suppose it just finds a really, really good policy for that reward function, then we realize, oh, whoops, we got the sign wrong or something. We want to multiply this reward by -1. Well, the AI predicts perhaps that if it allows us to shut it down, it won't be able to get its original reward anymore. It won't be able to do well. Instead, the new AI that's built will work against that original objective. And so it'd be incentivized to not let itself be shut down. This is part of the paper. So there's certain properties that just make reward functions and utility functions seem broken to me. And I think that this paper is telling us something important about smart agency, what optimal agency or rational agency tends to look like. And I'm hopeful that this will lead to more concrete insights about how to do better. I've got a couple guesses about how to do better, that currently it's not like, oh, and so here's how you just avoid it. Here's the predicate you apply that tests whether the policy is bad or not. I don't think that's feasible.
It's been my perception that one of the things AI alignment generally has been missing is just a concrete arena in which to reason about these systems, a perspective, a lens on the alignment problem that is mathematically tractable and lends itself to those kinds of insights. That was one of the things that I really like about this paper, is that it gives a definition of power seeking. It's no longer talking about, you know, qualitative terms like instrumental convergence, things like that, without pinning them to a specific kind of mathematical structure, which, as you say, I mean, that ties into deeper insights about, okay, what is the underlying mechanism, the thing that's causing this to go wrong? I guess there is an open question about whether it's the process of optimization itself, whether there's something intrinsic about just kind of moving the world. And I guess that's reward optimization. Maybe that's sort of what you're gesturing at there. But is there a broader sense of optimization that doesn't involve reward functions that you'd be more optimistic about? Or I guess I'm just curious about maybe some of those early thoughts you might have about better paths.
I think there is. I think I'm pretty sympathetic to the argument that if we do this well, we figure out alignment, things go great, and then we write a textbook like 100 years from now, or maybe like 40 years from now. Then if you showed me that textbook today, I'd think about it for a couple minutes and facepalm and realize that, of course, it's how you do it. But so I think there's some chance it's not like you need this crazy amount of mathematical foundations to even begin to understand alignment. It might be true that there's some simple reframings of the problem that would make things much easier. I think it's also plausible that there's not, and that we really need to build up like a new edifice of theory around how agents should interact with each other. But I think, yeah, I think that the successor work on what kinds of decision-making procedures will engender this these statistical incentives by which agents tend to seek power. It points to redirectability. So if you've got a parameter that kind of modulates the final behavior of the agent, in this case, in this original paper, it's the reward function determines what are the optimal policies. And if you can change, the optimal policies very well by just changing the reward function, then they just kind of redirectable. And so these redirectable agents often have power seeking incentives, at least in the settings we look at. You know, in the setting, like eventually they'll have power seeking incentives. Like you can imagine, well, so one kind of objection is, well, okay, so we don't see this today. We don't see this today as even in small settings. Like if you give you randomly generate a reward function for Pac-Man, that just each state has some randomly generated but fixed score. And it's like, well, Pac-Man's just gonna tend to die, right? Like he's not gonna tend to seek power. And the reason that's true is because the reinforcement learning algorithm can't find a good enough policy because it's too hard. The sample complexity is too high. It's just too, there's no structure to the problem. And so I think an entirely analogous situation holds in real life, where we might have an agent that we're training on a coherent objective, but our algorithms are just not good enough. And so it's not able to produce the policies that would be good. And so I think that's pretty true in the real world. And so I think once we start crossing that point, you might start to see some bad behavior. I think it's tied to that redirectability of the underlying algorithm. So I think that's a big part of the puzzle there. Is somehow we'd like something that is robust. We'd like a way of aligning an AI where we don't have to get the parameter just right in a way that you can't even iterate on very well, perhaps. Because if you mess up once with a very smart AI or a set of smart AIs, or even just 1,000 Facebooks, right? It's kind of hard to undo that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And do you expect that the failures of these systems will be obvious and non-catastrophic before they're catastrophic? Like, will we be able to learn and iterate based on more obvious kinds of failures that point to this underlying problem? Or is this more of an issue of an AI system developing enough abstract reasoning ability to realize, hey, I'm an AI system. I'm embedded in a computer. I can grow, my processing power by convincing, blah, blah, blah. You get the standard AI takeoff scenario.
Yeah, I think there's at least a 20% chance that we would see, if this kind of AI deception, let's say, is a problem where the AI, let's suppose that AIs tend to be incentivized to seek power. And one of the ways you can do that is by being deceptive, by pretending you're aligned so that you don't get corrected and shut off. Mm-hmm. This is just a way to avoid shutdown, like we talked about in the paper. Now, this is one modeling assumption you can make. We can talk about different ways of modeling the situation. I think all of the reasonable ways I can think of come out to the same conclusion, but I'll flag that I'm making, that the AI is thinking about itself being shut off and modeling that accurately. And saying, well, if I do this, it's not going to be very high scoring, so I'll just pretend to be aligned for now. Now, you might have AIs which are smart enough to think about this, but are still pretty dumb, and so they're kind of clumsily deceptive. Mm. Now, I think there's at least a 20% chance that conditional on this whole thing happening, that we would see some kind of clumsy failed attempt at deception that we can just recognize as dangerous. But I think even if like every researcher in the world at that point realized, oh, whoa, this is a problem, let's slow down and think about this. I mean, you still run into coordination problems, you still run into trust issues where you're like, well, we know that we have a culture of safety here at like Deepest Mind, but we don't trust these other organizations like Closed AI or whatever is going on. Yeah. It's just hypothetical future orgs. And so you still run into these like game theoretic issues with coordinating with each other. Like, I think it's just a pretty bad situation to be in. And I think an ideal situation would be, we've already worked out the theory for what to do here. We've got a competitive algorithm that doesn't have these issues. Let's run that instead. And it's incentivized for everyone to run that. It's like a low alignment tax. You don't have to, you don't lose a lot of performance on the metrics you care about by running the aligned version of whatever algorithm it is. This feels really hard to me, especially with the relatively low amount of effort we have put on alignment today. I'd really like to have this kind of thing before we run into a situation where we actually have a plausibly intelligent AI. So I really would like more work today working on this, well before we see it, because I think even if everyone could agree on the importance of the problem, if we got a warning shot, I think that we would still have problems coordinating.
I think that's, again,
the last couple of years to see, you know, a very clearly understood scientific phenomenon of pandemic that we have procedures for what to do about, and we just have problems implementing it. We have problems coordinating, and so bad things happen.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, hopefully the execution of this will be left up to more technically competent minds than the pandemic, in that the exponentials are happening in contained environments that are overseen by highly technical people who hopefully will be in a position to understand this better, but they have to understand it first. They have to understand what the stakes are, and they have to understand what the risks are. And that is why I'm so excited about this paper. I think it starts that kind of conversation. It's a critical tool for people who want to make this case, that there's a quantitative kind of backing behind this argument now. It's no longer just waving our hands around talking about world domination by AIs. There's something to point to, and it's highly suggestive. So thank you for putting that research together. If there's anything people want to ask you about with respect to that paper, are you open to them reaching out, Twitter, email, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. So I'll make sure that we put those links in the blog post that'll come with the podcast as well. Alex, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate your time on this.
Thank you.